Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit. We're here to talk about financial literacy. The last 4 weeks, actually the last 5 weeks? Last 4 weeks, we've had different guests on, and the focus has been financial literacy. Lester Austin started us off. He's with the Social Security Administration. Joe Sullender, certified financial planner. John was on that show, too.
With Lester, yes.
Yes, and John Elliott is here this morning. Sorry, John, I got so wrapped up in this financial literacy business, I wasn't literate enough to recognize your presence.
Well, that's okay.
Okay. So, and John was on with Lester, and then Joe Sullender came on with Tammy. Joe is a certified financial planner. Then Ray Kirk, recently retired from OPM, who has a real passion for financial literacy, and he talked about the different government programs for it, as well as computer sites and the like. And last week, we had Karen and Megan Schaefer talk about financial planning with a bent towards estate planning. And initially, somebody might say, well, somebody earlier on in their career, even mid-career, is concerned about estates as later in their career. Well, that was the thrust of the show. If you don't look at it early, it's sometimes too late to look at it late. So any one of those shows are archived on our website, NITPINC.com. We thought we'd ask for questions, and we sent out an email blast, and we got a pretty nice response. And I'll read the first question. Actually, this isn't zeroed in on financial literacy, but it's actually very psychologically tied into financial literacy. So the question is, can somebody in your panel explain to me why individuals plan their vacation to the last dollar but take very little time to educate themselves on financial literacy? And I guess the answer is it's fun to go on vacation. It's hard to learn financial literacy, but we're going to try to make it easier. But the question is really good because people pay attention to those things and maybe not to the longer run with regards to their finances. And the comment was, that's why the TSP hardship cases doubled during tough times when the government shuts down and they need additional money. Certainly, there was an increase in TSP loans, and whether those loans were taken in substantial numbers or not, just people just aren't necessarily conversant. You don't have to be able to teach a course in it, but you have to understand the miracle of, John talks about it often, compounding interest. What's that, the seventh wonder of the world?
Well, Albert Einstein said it's one of the miracles. One of two miracles, in his opinion. I forget what the second one, but one was, in fact, compounding interest. So if Einstein feels that way, I guess we all should.
Yes. And that's part of financial literacy. If I put money away today through the thrift, through savings, through investments, and I hold it for a period of time, I'm doing so not only for it to make money, but I'm doing it because it's got the miracle of compounding growth, and not necessarily
the easiest way to illustrate it is for yourself, to make it apparent to yourself, is go to the TSP calculator at tsp.gov and just take your account balance or start from zero or whatever baseline you want to start from and just project out. It's an easy-to-use software, and it's fun, actually, and you'll see how fast your money multiplies. If you assume 7% interest, which is not, you know, if you have enough invested in the stock market over time, you should be able to we hope you'd be able to realize 7%, but you can plug in any percent you want. But let's say 7%. And then every year, every 10 years, your money doubles.
Is that the miracle of 72s?
Could be. But you'll quickly see, if you use these calculators, how fast your money can multiply.
All righty. The basics, of anybody listening to this show, Fed-wise or other, but I would say it's about 99.9% federal, is the annuity or the pension. We're going to talk in a little bit about what's the difference between an annuity and a pension. And the question then is, I hear this often, and Tammy wrote an article last week in GovExec, I think it was last week, and talked about somebody, gee, if I stay another month, how would it impact my high three? Now, you're the benefits whiz, I'm not, but let me look at it from my viewpoint. If I stay another month to get a higher high three, then I get that 1 year at the higher, but I lose the what used to be the third year. And in today's environment, I mean, my high three, if I stay to get the higher high three, the new kid on the block will be the higher compensation than what it was 3 years ago, no?
Well, no. The simple way to explain, if you stay another month, you'll impact your high three almost nothing. It might go up a smidgen, but in other words, it'll drop, take 36 months as your high three. You'll drop off the beginning month, where presumably your salary was lower. Not always. Sometimes if you're frozen at the top of a GS-15, you may your high three may be your current salary. But for most people, what happens is you drop off the beginning month and add the latest month you stayed. Now, that would move the needle a little bit in terms of high three, but de minimis.
Right. Okay. That's what I'm in today's world.
That's the simplest way to explain it, because you're in your high three period. Every time your salary, however long you earned a salary, is prorated by, you know, if you had a X number of dollar salary for 5 months and then got a raise, whether that's a within grade, a promotion, whatever it is, then it'll capture that next higher amount for however long you earn it, and then go to the next higher amount if you get another raise and so on. But basically, it's prorated. And so staying a month isn't going to have much impact on your annuity.
Okay. So let's say no end grades, no steps, no whatever, and just a normal compensation level, and we got a 1% COLA.
Well, the 1% COLA would be factored into your high three.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But it would depend on
how many
months.
And it's not a COLA, strictly speaking. It's a pay
That's right.
adjustment. Only
pay.
Retirees get COLAs.
Okay. All righty. So it's going to be a benefit, but it's not going to be as large as what it might sound. It seems to me those are the questions that I've seen. If I stay another month, it'll impact my high three. Yes, it will, but marginally so.
No. If you wanted to get the full impact of your raise, you'd have to stay another 3 years to get the max impact. So if you got promoted from GS-12 to GS-13, you'd have to stay 3 more years to get the high three at your 13 salary.
Okay, but isn't the bigger impact if I have another year's worth of service, depending on whether I'm FERS or CSRS? If I'm FERS, I'm going to get at least 1% more in my annuity calculation. So if I work 30 years, I get 30%. If I work 31, I get 31%.
Right, unless you retire at 62, you get 1.1%.
Right, it could be more than that. It could, and then depending on your job category, firefighters, law enforcement, don't they get a higher?
They do.
Right.
1.7.
Right, okay. And then CSRSers are generally 2%. So that one additional year
after the first 10 years, it goes up to 2%. So all the rest of your career, it's 2%.
Okay, so it seems to me that's the bigger gorilla in the room than the COLA. But nonetheless, it's going to last for a lifetime. So from the basics, you need to understand what your annuity is going to be. It's going to be years in service and some type of high three, and then how you juggle that towards the end may or may not be worth the juggling. They might be able to go out and go to a second career, although that's not as easy as it sounds, but it might be a part-time second career. And if phased retirement comes in, we're not so sure how that would work. Somebody might look at that as well.
Well, OPM says, the latest from OPM, they haven't issued final regulations or even guidance, so nobody really knows how it's going to come out in every detail. But the projected date, they say now, is late this year. And that's the most recent communication from OPM on phased retirement. But basically, it's going to start out where they allow you to work 20 hours a week and then make up the difference with a prorated annuity. So you get half your salary, but then they give you, I guess, part of your annuity to make you whole as if you were working full time. And so it's tipping your toe into retirement to see if you like it, or to train your successor or whatever the reason. Of course, it has to be approved on a case-by-case basis. There's no guarantee that your agency will approve phased retirement for you. That's the final decision is up to the agency. So there are a lot of details to it. I can understand. I know a lot of people, it's not a lot, but some people are getting impatient. But I can understand, since I know what the system is like, it's hard to implement. But they're going to get it done because they have to, because it's the law.
Okay. So let's build our model. We're here to talk about financial literacy. With regards to our job, certainly is going to be the annuity. But the bigger thing to look at is, what do I spend? I mean, we can look at this beginning career, mid-career, more so at the end of career, because what you spend is what you're going to need to replace. I mean, it's got to come from someplace. We know it's going to come from this annuity, and maybe some comes from the TSP, maybe some comes from Social Security, and we covered those bases in previous shows. But I just want to set the stage. The thing you really have to look at first is, where am I going to spend my money? Now, initially, beginning career, nobody knows what they're going to spend 30 years from now, but they should know that the more that they can put away, the less problem they'll have 30 years from now. And we got some other questions. First question I just thought was really good coming out of the box. Here's another, I would say, a question. We talk about IRAs on the show. We talk about TSP. And somebody wrote in and said, what is a backdoor Roth? And you know, the question was, is it better than going in the front door? And actually, the question was good, because it's, some people can't go on the front door. If they want a Roth IRA and their income exceeds a certain level, they cannot put money directly in to the Roth.
Yeah, you want to have to go in the back door.
Yeah.
So that means you make more money.
If you can't get in the front door because of the size of your income, then you can still find a way to get money in with a current contribution, but you need to be careful here. First, it has to go to a traditional IRA. So picture kind of like a roadmap. Destination, Roth. Straight line, shortest distance between the two points would be from the one's cash to the Roth, but you can't do that. You can't go in the front door. So picture it kind of like a triangle. You go into a traditional IRA, and then as soon as it gets in there, you move it to a Roth. Sounds easy, doesn't it? However, there are issues. Inside of your traditional IRA or IRAs, these things are all kind of added together. They call this aggregating them. And to the extent that there is money in those IRAs, when they're all added together, that has not been taxed, then when we try to do what I'm suggesting, we're probably going to wind up paying tax, even if done within a second of getting the money into the IRA when they move it into a Roth. So they need to be aware of that. And the best way to track this, there's an IRS form 8606. It's extremely simple form to follow, and it really lays out to any individual that files it, they'll know what is in the IRA that is not subject to tax. Well, if you add up all the IRAs and it's equal to X, and your form says Y is what's already been taxed, then the difference is going to be taxable. If that is significant, there is an escape valve that can be moved into the thrift. And if all that's moved into thrift, by the way, that's the only type of money that can be moved into the thrift, fully taxable money. And the only thing left and then in the IRA would be the non-taxable. Move it over to the Roth with the new money, and you've effectively done what's called a backdoor Roth. It's not because it's a backdoor, because it's slick, or because it risks IRS scrutiny. It's just you can't go in the front door.
So, yeah, and refresh my memory on the moving to the TSP using Form TSP 60. You only move the earnings portion of your IRA to the TSP.
You cannot move anything but the earnings portion.
That's right. That's that right.
And it's actually simpler than what it sounds like, because let's say you have four IRAs. Well, which one's got which? Which one's got taxable? Which one's got non-taxable? And the answer is it doesn't make any difference because they're all aggregated. They call this the aggregation rule. So even though you could clearly define that one of them had the non-taxable portion, it doesn't make any difference. They have to be added together. The sum total, for example, let's say for a couple years somebody put money into their traditional IRA and they put in $6,000 for each one of those 2 years. They would have had $12,000 contributed that they got no tax deduction for. And let's say that included in their entire amount of their IRAs, it's $40,000. 12 plus 28 that's and been in there for a long time and made money. Well, anytime a dollar comes out, they're going to pay tax on the difference between, the fraction 12 over 40.
Yeah, I can't recall the term of art for the taxable portion, and the only reason I bring that up, I did that, or I did it for my spouse.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, to find out that taxable portion that isn't transferable into your TSP, I think it's been about 4 years, but you can call the management of whatever fund, and they're usually very friendly and accommodating and will be able to identify what portion, or they can send you a printout and you can just add up the figures yourself. I don't recall having any difficulty with it when I did it.
Well, some do, or some have changed IRA custodian, especially somebody that's had it in there for a longer period of time. I'm not so sure the mutual fund, if you will, can track it back that far. So they have to go to their tax return. Now, of course, they're supposed to file this Form 8606 that's been around since 1986, but everybody doesn't file it. It doesn't mean they shouldn't have. So you take your best effort and prepare it in case it was ever looked at. I'm not remotely suggesting this would create an audit, but it does create a path to get money into a Roth IRA. And actually, this this example came from a question. What other place can I save if one is maxing out the TSP and the catch-up, if they're of age, and maxing out a Roth IRA and it's catch-up? Well, you can't always put money into a Roth IRA, but you can always put money into a traditional IRA. Your income is not a factor here. You can make $8 gazillion a year, and you could still put money into a traditional IRA. If you wanted to move it over to a Roth, just be careful with this aggregation rule.
Yeah, you probably should see a tax specialist advisor. If you don't have one, find one.
Or you can listen to our August 13th, 2013 show where we graphically do it.
Okay.
But I think I'd probably agree with John. Talk to somebody that knows how this works. Next question we got, somebody said, I often hear the term annuity and pension mentioned with regard to the federal retirement system. Why do they call them two different things? And if they do, what's the difference?
As far as the federal FERS and CERS pension, there is no difference. It strictly, OPM calls it an annuity.
It is an annuity.
Which means you can't outlive it. That's the definition of an annuity. It's yours for life, and if you designate a spouse as a survivor for his or her life as well, that's what an annuity is. That's what you're getting if you're FERS or CERS.
But a pension can be guaranteed for life, but it may only last as long as there's money in the pot. In other words, who's guaranteeing the annuity? Federal government, safe bet, they're going to get some type of annuity, if not the full amount. I don't want to pick on Enron, but Enron, I don't think they're getting too much in the form of a pension or an annuity because the fund is gone.
Right.
Or if it's, I won't say Enron was not a reputable firm. Well, it wasn't at the end, but let's say a reputable firm. Let's call it X. Let's not use a name. Their pension fund, remember, it's not an annuity. Their pension fund is there for the employees that retire for life. But if that thing gets hit in the stock market or it makes some bad investments, then that money might not be there.
Yeah, I mean, pensions in the private sector are becoming increasingly scarce. They used to be ubiquitous, but over
Ooh.
The ubiquitous, common, all over the place. Popped up all over, a lot of companies paid pensions. But most do not.
And right.
A few still do, but that's the rule. That's the exception rather than the rule. So, but as far as we know, since our audience is federal, presumably, your FERS and CERS annuities are guaranteed by law. So they'd have to change the law, which they can do, but.
They could probably change it. I'm not so sure that they would do away with it. They might tweak it down.
Yeah, there is talk, and I'm not saying it's ever going to go anywhere because there's always talk about changes. But new federal employees, they're talking about doing away with the FERS part of the three-part system and just leaving new employees, not you current employees. Don't get scared, but... new employees, however that's defined, in the future, they just would have your TSP account and your Social Security, which really mirrors what is common in the private sector with 401ks and Social Security. But I'm a betting man, so I'm going to bet that's not going to happen, even to newer employees.
I think I'd agree. Now, let's take a look at another type of an annuity that a Fed might have. But better yet, let's take a phone call.
My name is Robert, and I had a quick question for you on required minimum distributions. I understand, at least my understanding, is that in determining what the ultimate required minimum distribution has to be, you have to take the year-end totals of all qualified plan accounts. In other words, that would include SEP IRAs, a 401k, the thrift savings plan, and in the year in which you turn 70 and a half, I think you have to basically take two distributions in that year. But simply stated, is it a correct assumption that you have to take the year-end totals of all of those qualified plans, the 401ks, thrift savings plan, SEP IRAs, traditional IRAs? Is that a correct understanding?
Okay, your question's great. We might spend a couple minutes on it, though. Okay?
Okay.
So one turns 70 and a half in a particular year. This is the only year they have this option. They say, okay, I'll take my required minimum distribution by the end of that calendar year, or I have a one-time deal that I can put it off till the next year. Then by April 1st of the next year, I take out a distribution which I otherwise would have taken out the year before. But because I'm in a second year now, I have to take the second one by December 31st. Okay, so once that's done, that's the only, well, what if. After that, it's pretty much exactly like you say. You look in the rearview mirror and you say, what was the value of my holdings at the end of December? And you divide it by some factor. So am I okay with that?
Yes.
Okay. Now let's fast forward. Each year... And they have a chart for this, of course. And it starts with 70 and a half, and you have to take out something based on a life expectancy of 27.4 years. Unfortunately, when you look at this chart, it looks like you have to take 27.4% of the money out. But it's you take that and you divide it into 100. Now, not to make anybody bleary-eyed, that works up to be about 3.65% that has to come out of, exactly like you say, these deferred tax accounts. Roth IRAs are not like that. Roth TSPs are. So there is no required minimum distribution from a Roth IRA, but that's not what you asked me. You asked me about traditional IRAs, 401ks, TSPs, etc. However, they are somewhat separated, the things with numbers associated with 401ks, 403bs, and whatnot. If you're still working, generally, but not always, you don't have a required minimum distribution if you're still working at 70 and a half or later. That's not a common situation, but I did want to say that for those listening. Said, no, I don't have to, but you do have to take it out of your IRAs. You just don't have to take it out of your TSP because the TSP is somewhat of a mirror image of a 401k plan. It just doesn't have the same number. So you're absolutely right in that regard. Now, am I okay so far answering your questions? Because this is kind of, I was going to...
Yes, sir. No, I'm following.
All righty. Now, recognizing that if you have money in an IRA or you have money in a TSP, you might say, gee, I'm looking for medium-term growth at 70 and a half, and now you're telling me I have to take the money out. Well, what you might do is, let's say you have a collection of IRAs. I'll use the example for them. You don't have to take an equal amount out of each one of the four. So you could have one that was set up to be somewhat cash intensive. It's not invested for the medium or the long term. It's there only to pay out the required minimum distribution. And it wouldn't harm the other ones that were set up for growth for later. So that's one option that you have that some people bristle and say, gee, I have to take it out of money that's really making me good money. Well, no, you don't. If you have more than one IRA, and certainly you can have more than one IRA, even if you only have one now, if for no other reason this. Did that make sense?
Yes. So in other words, if you have a mix of traditional IRAs, a SEP IRA, a 401k, and thrift savings plan, you can use your own discretion in terms of where or how many accounts you want to tap in order to take out that required minimum distribution.
Exactly. And you might just set up one account with equal in size to what you have to take out for a couple years and let the other ones grow unaffected by any distribution.
Okay. And I guess one quick final follow-up on that, Bob. If you have no basis in any of these accounts, in other words, if they're all pre-tax contributions, do you know whether or not you have to file Form 8606?
There's no requirement to do 8606 other than to establish basis. So if you don't have any basis, you don't have to file the form.
Okay, great.
And let me make one comment to that. Let's say some of the people listening to your good question say, I've never filed that form, and I have made non-deductible IRA contributions, am I going to be in trouble? Well, there's a mechanism to correct that. It's a very simple form. I mean, it's a really simple form. It's only got three lines that you need to be concerned about prior to distributions. And the first line says, how much did you put in for this year that you didn't get a tax deduction for? That should be pretty easy. How many years have you put money in, and how much have you put money in that you didn't get a deduction for in the past? That goes on line two. Line three says, add lines one and two. So it's simple. So let's say we didn't do it. We can file it by itself. This is odd. You can file this form by itself. There's a place to sign on the second page, and there is a penalty of $50 for each year that you don't do it. So I'm certain from your question you have no issues with this, but somebody else listening might go, oh, my goodness, how do I establish my basis? And that's how you do it. Okay?
Terrific. Thanks very much, Bob. I appreciate the time.
Thanks for the call.
And Robert reminded me that taxable portion are called basis points. So if you're contacting your administrator of your IRA, say, I need the basis point figure, and they'll know what you're talking about.
Oh, man. Basis points.
Yeah.
I understand what basis point is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Your basis. Basis points are like a penny to a dollar. Sorry.
But that... Anyway, that's...
Basis. What's your basis in the IRA? And that's what the gentleman just asked. Basis is the amount of money you put in where you didn't get a tax deduction.
Right. The non-earnings portion.
You got it.
Right.
And we got the economic benefit of the high three, we talked about that's important. We talked about the TSP, and we spent a lot of time with the TSP, but for the most part, unless you have a Roth TSP or you were in the military, you don't have any basis. It's 100% taxable. But the TSP does have an annuity. I wanted to get at that, and the annuity with the TSP is not guaranteed by the U.S. government.
No, it's how that works is if you elect a TSP annuity with all of your fund or portion of your fund, it's administered by MetLife Insurance. They've had the contract ever since I think TSP started. And so your account is sold to the MetLife company, you know, the Snoopy with the Snoopy company, and the dog. Anyway,
but it's not a dog.
It's a cartoon dog.
I know.
Yeah. Anyway, it's a big company. So once that happens, they agree to pay you an annuity again for life. Annuity is for life, so you can't outlive it. Now, there are a couple drawbacks to doing that. One, you lose all control of your money. You're giving it to MetLife. And they're taking your money, and guess what they're doing with it? They're investing it, just like you were doing before you gave them your money. My question is, if a sophisticated company like MetLife wants your money so they can invest it, why don't you continue to do the same thing? But if you insist on going the annuity route, and that might be because you just don't want to worry anymore. You just want that monthly income stream for the rest of your life. The other drawback is they don't pay COLAs on that annuity, and that's the big drawback because unlike your FERS and CERS pension that's indexed to inflation, the current CPI, you don't get a COLA on TSP annuities.
Unless you want to buy a rider.
Unless you want to take the option where you start with lower monthly payments and each year you graduate to higher monthly payments. So that is a hedge against inflation, but...
Okay, this is a good subject you bring up, and actually it's one of the questions. Both you and this is a question, and your first guest, Joe Selander, currently are not a big fan of the TSP annuity. My comment there is we're not necessarily against the TSP annuity. There's nothing wrong with the TSP annuity. It's administered by MetLife. It's, you'd say, the proverbial rock-solid firm. You would want your money with a rock-solid firm. But an annuity, as John just hit the bullseye with it, the company's got to make more money than what it's paying you, otherwise you won't get any annuity. So they have to take your money, and I do this in class. I break the class into four sections, and the marketing section says, you know, what would you like? And I'd say, well, I want a TSP annuity. How old are you? How much would you like to invest? Give them the number. Then the actuarial folks figure out what sex I am and why, because they know that statistically speaking, I'm going to live a certain number of years. Then the investment folks, as John indicated, says they have to make more money than what they're paying me over the period of time that I'm getting the money. And then the marketing folks come back in and say, well, don't say it's going to be 1% because we'll never sell anything. So in other words, any annuity, I don't care where you go, is based on interest rates in the market at the time. It's also based on the fact that the older you are when you ask for the annuity, the more you're going to get. Now, you say, well, why is that? Because there's less time to pay the person. And the person is certainly going to look for a greater rate of return on the money because they have less time to get it. So John hit the nail on the head with it. You're entrusting your money with somebody here that's extremely solid, but you're buying a ticket on a train. And the ticket has, generally speaking, one speed and one stop. You're going to get a flat amount for the rest of your life. Now, you'd say, well, gee, can't it go faster? Well, yes, but you're going to have to go slower initially. In other words, I want to buy the COLA rider to the policy. Then you can also buy a survivor rider to the policy, which is no different than the survivor rider to your federal government annuity. If you elect a survivor rider, you're going to get less during your lifetime.
Yes, and if you're FERS, you have to get your spouse's permission to not provide 50% to survivor, which lowers your annuity while you're alive.
Right.
But if you can convince your spouse not to take it, then fine, you can collect the full annuity, but then at your death it ends.
Okay, so the point we're getting at here is this is financial literacy. Now, we know we're going to get a federal annuity, and we know we're going to put money into the TSP. Why? Because we're going to use it to help fund our lifestyle once we do retire. But here we are. We've got the TSP. Do I buy an annuity with a portion of it? If I don't like the TSP annuity, can I get a better deal outside? Maybe. It most likely have to be through an IRA annuity. And then I've got Social Security, maybe, maybe not. CSRSers may have Social Security, but it's probably not going to be as robust as what a FERS person will have, because a FERS person, generally speaking, has been on the job for a while. And the longer you work, the more money you put in, the more money you put in, the more money you get out. Is that a safe assumption?
It is.
Then that gets us to the next issue. Again, we're doing financial planning here and financial literacy. Once you do leave federal service and you are FERS or you're offset, do you go after the Social Security as soon as you can? And correct me if I'm wrong, John, here, the longer you wait, the more you can get once you hit 70 and, what is it, 71?
No. Actually, let's say you were born between 43 and 54. Your full retirement age is 66. Whereupon you get 100% of your Social Security benefit. You go 62, it would be 75%. And each month you delay toward 66, you get a little higher amount. But they give you what they call delayed retirement credits. And for each year you wait after you're 66, then you get 8% more. So I will get a small Social Security benefit because I had work in the private sector as well as my government service. So I will get a Social Security benefit when I decide to collect it. But so far I haven't. I'm 68, so I've got 16% more than if I'd taken it. So I'm getting 116% if I take it, go home and apply for it online now. If I wait till 70, I get the full 32. Once you're 70, that's it. Then you better go collect it because you're not getting any increase unless you're, of course, still working, but let's assume you're not. Then at 70, I need to for sure take that because I'm not getting any booster after age 70.
Okay, so
any delayed retirement credit.
What we're probably looking at here is more a FERS individual that's dependent upon the three factors to fund retirement. CSRS is less so, because CSRS annuity is a lot higher than what the FERS annuity is. So when one retires, they where am I going to get my expense needs? Well, I have my FERS annuity. What else might I have? Might have a supplement. I have an option to take Social Security if I don't have a supplement, and I have an option to take the thrift. Well, maybe I don't need to take all three, and if I wait, like John says, till I'm older, each year I wait, I get a greater amount from Social Security. Well, if I wait, that means the money's got to come out of the thrift to fund the gap between my FERS annuity and my spending habits. So I'm going to have to draw down against that, probably, not necessarily, or you might have some traditional IRAs. You know, you don't have to draw from the thrift until you hit 70 and a half, assuming you left service before 70 and a half. So that one's that's a tough one. Where do you draw that money down to fill the gap between your FERS annuity and your eating habits? And probably Social Security is where you want to go last because it's got such a great compounding effect. So I don't know the answer to that one, but if it does come out of an IRA, you're going to have partially taxable, partially not. If it comes out of savings, it's going to not be taxable whatsoever. And that's probably a whole show in itself, but that gets into a lot of numbers that maybe we need to do concept here. And we also need to call the show, 202-465-3080, 202-465-3080. Another email question came in and said, let's say I have my TSP half in stocks and half in bonds. Upon retirement, can I ask TSP to make my yearly distribution solely from the stock portion until it becomes zero and then the bond portion? And the answer is no.
No.
It comes out pro rata. Now, how could you get around that? You could take half of the TSP, transfer it out, and put it into an IRA bond fund or an IRA stock fund that parallels the TSP funds. Now, the TSP funds are mirrored over a private industry. The stock fund, if you will, the more common of the two, is the C fund, and it's mirrored on something called a Standard & Poor's 500 stock index fund, which is easily found there as well as outside. There's another stock fund, and it's the S fund, and it's the other 4,500 companies.
Smaller than the 500
biggest.
Largest companies.
All righty, and that can be found outside as well. Now, the bond fund is called the F. I guess F stands for fixed. It's a fixed investment.
Fixed income, yeah.
Now, it actually has government bonds in it. Not a huge percent, but it does have government bonds in it. But it has corporate bonds that gives you a better rate of return. Now, looking over the shoulder, I had a friend once say, in the long run, everybody's right. But in the long run, things will go up, things will go down. But the F fund gets very skittish when interest rates rise because anything you bought in form of a bond has a duration period that isn't necessarily short. It's not going to be 2 months, not going to be 3 months, it's probably not going to be less than 5 years. So if interest rates go up, the value of your holdings go down. You don't lose any money unless you cash it out, but the value goes down and people just kind of have a real adverse reaction to value going down. But that's one way to get best of both worlds. And truth of the matter is, if you do that for a while and you felt like, gee, I shouldn't have done that, you can always move money out of your IRA back into the thrift. Remember that John here
using
the TSP form?
60.
Yes.
And it's downloadable at tsp.gov. Just click on Forms and Publications and you'll quickly find it. And you can print it out
And make sure you use the most recent version. They've had two versions probably in the last year and a half.
Yeah, but if you go online.
And you go online, you can't miss it.
You can't miss it. But if you get it out of your HR office when you leave, who knows?
Yeah. All righty. 202-465-3080. We still have some emailed questions in here. And one says, what other place can I save if one is maxing out the TSP and I put money into the Roth and maybe I put money into the traditional? I mentioned this one before. Should I go to the Roth should I go to the TSP first? I would say if you're younger than mid-career, I might jump all over that. Once I hit mid-career, my tax rate's higher. The traditional TSP is probably more of benefit. Early on in one's career, the Roth TSP, it's just the way to go. The income is the lowest you're probably ever going to have, which also means the lowest. I'm talking about young beginning career. And it has an awful lot of time to grow tax-free. As you travel down the path, then mid-career, the tax deduction means more to you, and certainly pre-retirement, the tax deduction means an awful lot to you, although I've met a number of people that say, listen, I've got enough money to pay the tax. I want the money in the Roth because I want my heirs to enjoy the benefit of tax-free income from this investment for life. I can't argue with that one. But this takes the question and it goes a bit further. Outside of those two, how about a cautiously picked investment? And I know I'll get a lot of calls now. Tell me one. I don't know one. If I did, I wouldn't be on the air, I don't think. So the issue here then would be, if I'm going to invest, I want to look for something that has a good to better rate of return that is reasonably safe. Nothing's going to be as safe as a government bond. I mean, the C fund has enjoyed a great life, the S fund, the I fund, the L funds, but they all have stocks in there, and they have, quote, risk. We talked an awful lot about risk last week. Risk doesn't mean you're going to risk losing all the money. It just means you might not make as much as the guaranteed investment inside the G, but, you know, maybe it's worth the risk.
Yeah, I mean, almost any financial planner you'll ever hear from on this show and elsewhere would say have a mix of stocks and bonds. Everybody's heard you should diversify your investment, but if you have it all in bonds, it's not over time. History has shown that it won't grow nearly as fast if you invest in stocks. At least half of it in stocks, if not more, and much more when you're younger. When you're starting out, you want to be almost all stocks, maybe 85-90% stocks and the remainder in bonds. And as you get older, you might want to get more conservative. Now, we had one financial planner on the show a month or so ago who's very bullish on the L funds, where kind of your movement from higher risk, so-called, to lower risk bonds is done for you over time. So I forget the date of that show, but it was in March, I think, of this year. John Gillick was the name of the guy, so you can go to the archives if you want to listen to that show.
Anyway, so then the question with taxes, we kind of danced around taxes only because taxes are, I would say, hard to understand the concept. The concept is you're going to pay taxes on, quote, taxable income. So if you had your druthers, you'd like to get non-taxable income, but that's not going to be, that's going to be near impossible with somebody's salary or money coming out of the TSP. But what is a tax rate? Tax rates, if you're in a certain tax bracket, that doesn't mean all your income is taxed at that level. Tax brackets are like walking upstairs. You walk into a building, ground level is the lowest level. That's the lowest tax bracket. It's 10%. Doesn't last long, but it's 10%. The next level is 15, lasts a bit longer. Then it jumps to 25. Then it goes to 28. We could go on, but let's try to cover the waterfront here. So if somebody is in, say, the 25% bracket, the next dollar that they get, they're going to pay tax of 25% on it. Now, if they live in a state with a state income tax bracket, that might be 5%. That's a 30% hit. So when looking at what one has to spend, they really need to understand what money they're going to have, but more so, what money are they going to have after taxes? And the only really good way to do that, if you use a computer-aided software product, save your return and then plug in a pretend return and plug in your retirement income. And then you'll know what the taxes are going to be. Subtract the taxes from what the cash flow is, and you should be good to go. If you use a tax professional, ask them to do it. If you do it by hand, you have my admiration. But I've met a few recently, and these returns were not, you know, just kids' returns with a W-2 and interest. They were, you know, a worker's return, and they did it right. That's very hard to do in today's world. But anyway, what I'm getting at is if you don't know what your taxes are, but you know what your income is, after tax, that income might not be enough to satisfy your income needs. John, you got...
I just got Andrew, our engineer, just informed me that John Gillick was on March 24th of this year. So you just go to March 24th in the archives if you want to listen to that show and learn about the L Fund and other things as well. March 24th, 2014.
Okay. I'm just looking at all the emails, and they look more like spam than the ones we want, so I don't think I'll read the spam ones.
Okay.
Nobody's going to argue with that one. So we covered taxes. We covered the growth of income. Last week, we talked about wills and trusts, and even the beginning career, folks. A will, you know, how... where are my assets going to go? Maybe there's not too many assets at that point, but as one starts to accumulate, whether they get married, whether they don't get married, the orderly distribution of them, and without a will, it might not go to the people that you want it to go to. Not everybody marries, but once they marry, you might have the two spouses wanting the money or the assets to go to different places than the one wants it, but it's only fair. Anyway, Andrew has told us we're close to the one-minute mark. John, it's been 5 weeks here, huh?
5 weeks.
I think this is the fifth week of the financial literacy show.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, and this is the last show on the
financial literacy. This is on financial literacy if anybody calls up.
Right. I mean, we discuss these issues all the time. It's so it's not over necessarily. You can, as Bob says, you can call in with any question anytime, and most of the time we know the answer.
Yeah. And if we don't, we're honest enough to say, I don't know.
Or have an opinion.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we appreciate you listening. Hopefully, you're listening after we go off the air. You could email us at forourbenefit@nitpinc if you have lingering questions. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.
This is John Gilroy from Fed Tech Talk. Wanted to tell you about a local company that has had a national impact on airline safety. For the past three decades, Electromech has worked with federal agencies to make sure aircraft wiring is safe and reliable. Electromech is responsible for testing, inspecting, and analyzing a wide range of electrical wire interconnect systems. For a white paper on addressing fleet management needs, please visit electromech.com. That's L-E-C-T-R-O-M-E-C.com.